This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Jimmy Mitchell is director of campus ministry at Jesuit High School in Tampa and founder of Love Good, a formation platform for Christians focused on beauty. His new book is Let Beauty Speak, The Art of Being Human in a Culture of Noise, which has actually a lovely photo of Milan Cathedral on the cover. Welcome, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a privilege to be with you.
It really is a culture of noise. It's barbarous and jarring and dispiriting. Has it ever been worse on that score?
It doesn't seem like it. You know, I just read a recent article that outlines some of the statistics, even just on smartphones. The average American right now spends 7 to 9 hours a day behind the screen of their smartphone, and over 100 pickups. We're talking about random interruptions as notifications come in. We just live in a noisy, distracted culture, and that makes our souls very noisy and distracted.
So, Jimmy, I don't think I've seen that kind of statistic before. The number of pickups, just sort of a ding, a text message from, you know, a political campaign. That's actually a very good statistic. The pickup, because it's an interruption, right? How can you concentrate with 100 pickups a day?
That's right. I mean, I think about Joseph Pieper's understanding of leisure. He talks about contemplative beholding, an immersion in the real, you know, this kind of stillness that allows us to encounter reality. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what happens when we're constantly interrupted, constantly distracted. There's no stillness. There's no silence in a world that is so fraught with noise, with busyness. And I'll be the first to admit, I struggle with that. I'm striving constantly to have mastery over my technology, over just the political discourse of our era, all the things that are constantly bombarding us, keeping a deep undercurrent of peace. I mean, that's a work of the Lord. It can only be done by Him.
You know, we could talk about different forms of damage for young people. They don't read enough books, you know, and the social media piles all this emotional stuff, complication into their heads. But you actually identify maybe the greatest damage is that it has, quote, this is your phrase, numbed our infinite desire for God. You see that in the young?
I do, time and time again. I work at an all-boys school in Tampa, Florida, and I began working there full-time during the pandemic. And I was shocked by their openness and their hunger for truth, for beauty, and for goodness, because the world just continues to disappoint them, and it leaves them empty over and over and over again, you know, with promises of connection on social media, promises of intimacy with pornography, empty promises after empty promises, and there's this deep existential ache that rises up in their hearts over time, and they realize they're made for more. There's got to be something more than what this world is giving them.
Let me ask about your school. What is your cell phone policy at the school?
That's a good question. We don't allow cell phones at all during the day. So basically up until the 8 o'clock bell rings. And then as soon as that last bell at 3:23 rings, there are no phones. And that's a really helpful policy, you know, and we're not, you know,
Do they just turn them off and leave them in their backpacks or their lockers, or you have them leave them at the door?
Yeah, no, it depends on the teacher. Most of them have them in their pockets, which I think is actually a healthy sort of lesson for life. How can I have technology, engage with it, but not let it take over? How do I use it as a tool, like a hammer in my pocket, you know, not something I'm enslaved to? And I think, you know, we struggle with this, obviously, but as a school, we're doing our darndest there. You know, for example, on all of their retreats, you know, whether it's a 1 day or a 3 day retreat, they turn in their phone as soon as they walk in the door. They don't see it again until they leave. And while they kind of pitch a fit when they're freshmen, they're utterly grateful by the time they're seniors because they're so grateful to just be detached, to have nothing to worry about in their pocket. It really, for most of them over time, becomes a cause for constant stress and anxiety, not even the dopamine rush, you know, that they maybe first enjoyed when they first got their phones, sometimes in the fifth grade. Now it's just become a cause for anxiety for so many of them.
Yeah. And this is really one of the big issues for you. This is where beauty comes in, because to break into that relationship between the kids and the noise, to unnumb them to the infinite desire for God, doctrine doesn't much help, right? Just sort of moral axioms, that doesn't do it.
That's exactly my instinct. It's also been my experience of the last 15 years. You know, truth and goodness have been sidelined by the dictatorship of relativism, as Pope Benedict once coined it. And that means that the only way to break through, to really even get people awakened to the possibility of truth and a life of goodness, is to arrest their hearts with beauty. And obviously, there's so many ways that this happens without us even trying, right? We can't help but feel a little speechless when we stand before a sunset on the Gulf of Mexico, you know, or atop a mountain range in East Tennessee or the Rockies out west, or when we hold a newborn child in our arms. There's a universal experience of beauty there that most of us can't put into words, that fills our heart with a wonder and a gratitude. And, you know, to borrow a phrase from G.K. Chesterton, there's never a sadder moment in the life of an atheist than when he's filled with a feeling of profound gratitude with no one to thank. It's our hope, my hope, to help people connect the dots between obviously creation and the creator, you know, these encounters with beauty and the author of beauty, and let that gratitude turn into a prayer of thanksgiving.
Yeah. You know, one thing I started seeing, what, about maybe 30 years ago, I was just a very young teacher, you know, a graduate student, and starting to see filter into younger kids this kind of nihilistic irony, you know, the sort of smart alecky, but also almost pointed at the higher things, you know, the attitude of I know better. They don't have that, do they? They don't have the transcendent.
Right. I mean, what you're referring to, I think, is often just summed up by like the cynicism that grows in each of us as we get older and we feel like, you know, maybe we've got life figured out. But actually, most people who are cynical, actually all people who are cynical, are also miserable because they've lost that childlike wonder. They've lost the innocence of youth, right? And I'll tell you, what's really fascinating is we have an entire generation now that's growing up in a post-Christian culture. They're kind of given access to the vestiges of Christian values, but they're not receiving doctrine. They're not being evangelized or catechized. So what happens is they get to a high school like ours down in Tampa, and suddenly they're being formed in the fullness of the faith with a rigor and a precision that is pretty uncommon at the high school level. They're being brought into a $10 million chapel every day to hear beautiful music and to experience beautiful liturgies a couple of times a month. That for many of them is the beginning of a conversion. They go on these retreats, you know, that are half an hour drive away from campus, that just pull them out of their concrete jungles, you know, living in the cities and the suburbs. And suddenly they're surrounded by nature and they can actually tap into the deeper desires. And I think that's what's so beautiful, is the openness of this generation is really striking compared to the, I will just say, cynicism of my own. You know, millennials, they grew up with a lot more faith than Gen Zs. And I think what I'm noticing is because of that lack of experience, that lack of baggage, that lack of even wounds from the church per se, in a typical high school student today, gives them a greater openness and a receptivity and a hunger, because basically their lives don't have a lot of meaning or purpose anyways. They're looking for something.
Yeah. You want that experience of awe and wonder to hit them. And one of the things that you say wonder produces is a form of humility. How does that work?
Oh, I mean, wonder, of course, is what happens whenever we encounter beauty, truth, goodness, any transcendental moment that we can't immediately explain, that we're looking for, you know, some reason for its purpose. And I think with that comes this curiosity, this wonder that leads to knowledge, and a knowledge that ultimately leads to love, you know? So I think a lot of us could recognize that, you know, if beauty is an arrow that kind of pierces the heart and wounds us, to borrow a phrase or an image of Pope Benedict XVI, and once wounded, the heart can't help but trace the arrow back to its source, who is, of course, God himself, the author of all that is true and good and beautiful. If beauty is the arrow, wonder is the sharpening stone. It's what helps us be more open, receptive, even sensitive to those encounters with beauty that can actually set us free, that can ultimately lead us to the truth that's inseparable from that beauty in the first place. And ultimately, that truth is Christ himself.
At one point, you quote Romano Guardini, who says, quote, "The greatest things are accomplished in silence." And kids don't have much silence these days, do they?
They certainly do not. You know, we take 25 of our seniors on a three-day silent retreat every single school year. And what always amazes me is how many of them come back raving about it and then convince all of their friends that it was one of the best experiences of their lives. And we're almost forced into hosting another silent retreat later in the year for all the guys that now suddenly want to go on it. You know, silence has a healing, I think, power, especially in this culture of noise. You know, one of the books that really shaped me a few years back was by Cardinal Seurat, The Power of Silence Against the Dictatorship of Noise. You know, all the greatest things in salvation history, and certainly in my own life, I can say, began in silence, in stillness, in this, you know, kind of quiet preparation for the activity of God. You know, I mean, this is sort of one of the truisms of especially Catholic spirituality, that long before we can go and become apostles and take great action on behalf of God and his church, we have to be contemplatives. You know, I think often about St. Francis Xavier, who basically, you know, worked himself to death after 10 years of priestly ministry. You know, he baptized 400 souls a month, and ultimately about, you know, ended up being, multiply that out by 12 times 10, I can't remember the number, but we're talking tens of thousands of people baptized in his missionary endeavors. But he often spent all night in adoration, all night in contemplative prayer. There was a stillness that preceded the action, and it's the very thing that fueled it as well.
You know, I found young people, they get to the point where the silence is almost hard on them. Is it that the silence brings about a loneliness that is hard to endure? Have you seen that?
It's a great point. I have heard so many times the hesitation with silence coming back to this fear of being alone. If you're silent, you have to reckon with yourself. And let's face it, a lot of people don't like themselves. A lot of people aren't happy with where their lives are or where their lives are going. Silence forces reflection. It forces an examination of conscience, you might say, even for the non-Christian, for somebody who isn't thinking about sin and redemption, who just realizes, well, my life is actually a bit more of a mess than I realized, and I'm now stopping long enough to consider that fact. Yeah, I think silence is scary because it often demands something of us, and it invites a deeper conversion or a transformation of some kind that without the silence, we're not even aware of. We're not even realizing the need for, and we certainly will never find the strength to actually, you know, pursue. So I find silence to be scary in my own life, especially when things are difficult, especially when I'd rather just anesthetize whatever is, you know, sort of causing pain on the inside. You can anesthetize that with busyness. Silence forces the wound to be revealed, perhaps, and therefore a process of healing that can often be quite painful to begin.
You know, in your book, you mentioned the story of William Wallace. What is that story? How's it relevant here?
Well, I mean, I think all men of every generation have appreciated the great story of William Wallace. I mean, long before Mel Gibson made his life famous in that movie Braveheart back in the 90s. You know, there was a book about William Wallace that was the most printed, published, and read book in the entirety of Scottish history, next to the Bible, for several hundred years, right? So this has been a figure in the minds and imaginations of especially men for a long time. I love his story, and I especially love kind of the intensity of how his life ended. You know, like many of our own great, you know, martyrs in the Catholic Church. I mean, the guy was basically disembodied and therefore, you know, scattered all over Scotland as an example of what not to be. And of course, he was leading a freedom fighting revolution so that Scotland could be its own country, you know? And I think all of us on a really personal level can recognize that we have to wage war against our egos. We have to wage war against our vices. We have to wage war against anything and everything that enslaves us from being truly free. And that's a freedom deep in the interior that for most of, you know, the last couple thousand years, we've called virtue, you know, this ease, this joy in choosing the good and not only knowing what is good and obviously, you know, willing what is good, but even desiring what is good, which is a whole nother level of virtue and freedom that most of us don't talk about.
Freedom, you actually align social media with an attack on freedom, a loss of freedom. But don't social media give us personal empowerment, Jimmy? That's what I've been told.
It does seem that that's the lie, you know? I mean, here's the reality, especially with just the rise of what I'll call surveillance capitalism. That's a phrase I first read from Shoshana Zuboff. She's a professor at Harvard. And she talks about how for the first time in human history, we have become the commodities, right? You know, our behavior, especially our consumer behavior, is not just being tracked. It's being modified. It is being altered and manipulated, not only by social media, but any company with an algorithm that traces our behavior online. And that's a scary place to be when suddenly, you know, you realize I'm losing a bit of my control here. You know, like I'm finding myself, you know, going down rabbit holes that I don't even deep down see as interesting or intriguing. And it's because these again, algorithms are beginning to shape us and manipulate us and take us obviously down, you know, paths that we don't want to go. I mean, the pornography industry alone, over $100 billion global industry, points to this fact of how, you know, ugly and how twisted, you know, our lives can become very, very quickly if we don't have mastery, joyful self-mastery, especially over social media.
Yeah. You know, we've got a chapter on prayer that it opens with an experience that you had in the Derg. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's correct. Loch Derg.
The Loch Derg. What was that experience? How's that relevant here?
I'm so happy you brought that up. Most people don't ask about that. Most people have never heard of it. Loch Derg is this island in Northern Ireland that has been a place of pilgrimage for almost 1,500 years, dating back to the time of St. Patrick's. It's often nicknamed St. Patrick's Purgatory. And they say that at any given moment, the spiritual health of Ireland can be easily analyzed by the number of pilgrims on Loch Derg. They have enough beds for a few thousand people to spend the night there over a 72-hour pilgrimage. And the reality is right now, you're rarely seeing more than a few hundred there. It's only open June, July, and August. And by the time you've walked out of the door, you have prayed somewhere north of 1,200 Hail Marys, 800 Our Fathers, 400 Apostles' Creeds. The whole nature of the pilgrimage is you don't eat for 3 days. You don't sleep the first 40 hours that you're there. And then you go through these prayer rotations over and over and over again until you're worn down to the last bit of self that you could find. And you walk in for these masses every day and these times of confession and adoration in the midst of it all. And you're so aware of your brokenness, you know, in the same way that Lent is meant to remind us of our need for God, our dependency on God, you know, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving of 40 days are kind of taken and concentrated into this 3-day experience at Loch Derg with very similar results. And I found myself weeping on the closing mass of that 3-day pilgrimage, realizing my own desperate need for God, that, you know, so often I fall into this sin of self-reliance, I would call it, thinking that somehow, you know, my salvation or other people's salvation depends on me. But really, it's all the Lord. And the posture of prayer that all of us, I think, are hoping to cultivate every day is one of humility, dependency, and trust that an experience like Loch Derg really brings to the forefront.
Very good. You know, I agree with you that prayer is the most effective and easy way to escape the noise. I mean, it's a daily blessing. Why don't more young people engage in it? They just don't know?
I think they don't know. You know, it reminds me of a quote by C.S. Lewis. He says that most people don't even long for virtuous friendship because they've never experienced it before. The same is true for prayer. Most people don't long for the peace, the joy beyond all understanding that Christ gives us every day in the interior life. They don't long for it. They don't practice it because they've never experienced it. So this is something that I'm very convicted about, that, you know, whether it's on a retreat, whether it's in your family life and culture, whether it's in your parish or your school, finding opportunities to really teach young people how to pray. And it's got to be more than, we'll say, vocal prayers or devotional prayers. There's got to be something personal and something, I would say, pretty profound and even vulnerable about our prayer lives if it's going to sink into our hearts and change us for the better. So, you know, St. Teresa of Avila talks about mental prayer, this conversation with God that we're meant to engage in every day, a loving dialogue with God as a father, as a friend. She says, if we don't practice that for 15 minutes a day, we will not need a devil to throw us into hell. We will throw ourselves in, you know? To put it more positively, Alphonsus de Liguori says that, you know, all the saints became saints through mental prayer. And Mark, I'll tell you, I'm so impressed with some of the young men that I work with at this all-boys school in Tampa. I know right now, 4 guys who for Lent are committed to showing up in our school chapel at 6:45 every morning for half an hour of mental prayer before 7:15 Mass. And they have told me that it has already transformed their life. Just these first 4, 5, 6 days of Lent have felt like a whole new way to be human, because they're starting their days with a peace and a confidence that can only come from the Lord.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing you know about the noise as well is that it doesn't only dispirit individuals, but it creates, this is your term, unhealthy communities. Well, give us an example of that.
Well, that's such an interesting point, you know, because there's an illusion of community online, and most of those communities are pretty unhealthy. But also, you know, let's just take an average work community or school community. Anywhere that you would find yourself using the word community, even your parish, if there's not a rootedness in prayer, a love that is born out of silence, a humility that kind of guides all the virtues that you're, you know, striving to live as a community, then it can become toxic very, very quickly. You know, I think very much about the rule of Saint Benedict. And obviously, as the father of Western monasticism, we have so much to be grateful for, because Benedict, in many ways, gave rise to and very much preserved not just, you know, monasticism, but Western civilization for so many centuries with that rule. And I think there's a lot to be learned there for us, that, you know, communities as this way of being human and living our humanity and even evangelizing others without trying to, is really, really important, especially in an age where loneliness is on the rise. I mean, there was just a report out by the U.S. Surgeon General a few months ago describing loneliness as an epidemic. And he's going on and on about the health risks, the depression, even the rise of illnesses and cancers and certainly, you know, suicide, all connected or all traceable back to loneliness. And community is, of course, the one of the great remedies for that.
You know, they're so busy, aren't they? That phone is busy, 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 constantly checking things. What's your advice to that rushed soul when they feel, no, I have to, I'm so busy. What do you say to that youth in your school?
Yeah, I mean, there's such an illusion of importance, of self-importance when we're busy. I mean, think about the average answer to the question, hey, how you doing, man? Like, how are you? People say, oh yeah, busy, good, but busy. Yeah, it's almost like a calling card. People are so impressed with themselves for being busy. But I think a far better word is you know, life is full. If life is full, that implies that there's a lot going on, but you have an order to your life. You have an intentionality to how you're living. You know, I think busyness is something that we can easily push back against, not only with our language, but most importantly with our lifestyle. So, you know, I turned off my phone about 7-8 years ago and ended up with, you know, an Apple Watch, for better or for worse. That means I have not heard my phone ding at me or ring in as long as I've had this watch. And the watch only buzzes for the very things that I'm willing to be interrupted by. And on top of that, I've deleted social media from my iPhone. I don't have access to YouTube, to Netflix, to Amazon Prime. I just found that those things were like sinkholes, you know? And often it's in a moment of exhaustion or a moment of even true leisure that gets hijacked by this kind of spirit of loafing that I think I deserve because my life is so quote unquote busy. But I think this is really where leisure and work need to be integrated so that our lives are not busy, nor are they prone to laziness and loafing, but they're truly full. And with that fullness comes an abundance and comes a sense of purpose and joy that every person on planet Earth longs for.
Well, you're on the front lines working with the kids, Jimmy, so I admire you for that. For now, the book is Let Beauty Speak, The Art of Being Human in a Culture of Noise. Jimmy Mitchell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark.